NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at WTGrantFoundation.org.
WILL programming is made possible by Columbia Street Roastery, roasting coffee daily at 24 East Columbia in Champaign. Also offering a variety of tea and chai. Open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. to 5:15 p.m. and Saturday mornings from 9 to noon. More information is available at 352-9713. Today's broadcast is made possible by Carl Foundation Hospital. Carl Foundation Hospital provided more than $80 million in community benefit last year, including almost $10 million in free or discounted care. More information about how Carl embraces its charitable mission is in its annual report at carl.org.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. 7 minutes past 1 o'clock. We were scheduled this afternoon to talk with Andrew Lee about Wikipedia, but that has fallen through, so we'll try and reschedule this. In the meantime, we'll go to the archives and we'll rebroadcast an interview conducted earlier this year by myself of Tom Gelton, award-winning NPR correspondent covering intelligence and national security issues. He's the author of Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba, the biography of a cause. That's coming up next. Now, because this is a recorded program, we won't be taking calls this afternoon. Thanks. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2. WILL broadcasts from Campbell Hall for public telecommunication, thanks to the generosity of University of Illinois alumni Alice and Robert Campbell. Good afternoon. My name is Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. Journalist Tom Gelton begins his new book, Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba, with a look at the label on a bottle of white Bacardi. On the label, you find it described as Puerto Rican rum. But as Gelton points out, the roots of Bacardi and the makers of Bacardi, the Bacardi family, are not in Puerto Rico. They are in Cuba. In this portion of the program, we'll get a glimpse of the story of Bacardi and what it has to tell us about the story of Cuba. In the words of our guest, Tom Gelton, the history of Cuba can be narrated around tales of rum. It has been a symbol of Cuban life from the days of sugar and slaves through the Castro era. Listeners, you're welcome to join our discussion with your questions and comments. I look forward to your phone calls. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Tom Gelton is an award-winning reporter for NPR, currently covering national security issues. He has also served as a foreign correspondent for NPR. His honors include awards from the Overseas Press Club, a George Polk Award, and a Robert F. Kennedy Journalism Award. In addition to his work for NPR, Tom Gelton is a regular panelist on the PBS program Washington Week. Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba, the Biography of a Cause, is Gelton's second book. It is published by Viking. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Tom Gelton, so good to talk with you. How are you?
I'm good, Celeste. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Well, as you point out, the most distinctive part of the Bacardi label is that bat. What's the significance of the bat?
I think your listeners, you and your listeners, would agree with me that the bat is one of the more creepy symbols that could adorn a bottle of such a popular product as Bacardi rum. So it really does require a bit of an explanation, and it is a kind of a historical, cultural explanation. There are many different stories behind this the placement of the bat as the symbol. But the bottom line is that the bat, back in the middle of 19th century in Cuba and back in Spain as well, was actually seen in a pretty affectionate way. I mean, the bat was a symbol of good fortune. And back in Catalonia, the region of Spain from which Facundo Bacardi, the founder of Bacardi rum, came from, the bat was, again, considered an icon of good luck. What I found in an old document in Cuba about this bat symbol was a belief from Catalonia that bats were a symbol of good fortune because they exemplified the ideal of brotherhood, because they lived and flew together. They symbolize self-confidence because they can fly in the dark without hitting anything. They stand for discretion because they keep silent, as you know, and they represent faithfulness because they always return home. I thought that was a real sort of charming summary of the positive traits of the bat and a convenient explanation for why it was put on the bottle of rum founded by a family that, in fact, came from Catalonia.
Yeah, and the bat, as you know, it always returns home, and the Bacardis, those who now make rum in Puerto Rico and Mexico, are thinking about returning and once again making rum in Cuba. Why are they contemplating a return? What is leading them back to Cuba?
I think there are a couple dimensions to that issue, Celeste. One is that, as you have learned from reading my book, the Bacardi attachment to Cuba goes way back and is felt very deeply. I mean, the Bacardis are not alone among Cuban exiles in feeling their Cuban identity deeply, but this is an especially strong attachment between the Bacardis and Cuba. And it's an emotional attachment. It's a historical attachment. The Bacardis, for so long, were associated with the kind of the Cuban national cause. And that has survived, even though they've been in exile now for going on 50 years. So sort of emotionally, they still feel that. But there's also a kind of a more prosaic aspect of this, which is that the Bacardi Rum Company is a very successful spirits company, and the Cuban rum industry, the rum industry in Cuba is one of the very few bright spots in that otherwise disastrous economic picture there. And in the post-Castro period, there's bound to be a lot of competition over who's going to be able to control the rum industry. And this is, the Bacardis sort of feel, one, that it's kind of, that they have a claim to it, that this is by rights theirs. They founded the Cuban, what we know as Cuban rum. And secondly, they just simply recognize this is a great commercial opportunity and they'd like to be in there fighting for it.
Yeah. Emilia Comas Bacardi, a great-granddaughter, a great-great-granddaughter of Don Facundo Bacardi, the founder of the company, was the first of the U.S. Bacardis to return in 2002. Tell us a little bit about what she told you about what that return was like and what her expectations had been.
Well, you know, the Bacardis, when they left Cuba, they left with a great deal of anger against Fidel Castro. They had been big supporters of him in line with their sort of progressive political history in Cuba. They had gone out on a limb to support him. And then when he expropriated all their property and houses and basically pushed them out of the country, they quite naturally felt deep anger about that, and enough that most Bacardis don't want to go back to Cuba as long as Fidel Castro is alive, as long as the Castros are in charge. So she had to sort of overcome some resistance from the rest of her family because she did want to go back. She wanted to go back really more for personal than for political reasons. She had grown up there. This was the place where she had spent her childhood and her adolescent years. She had very strong attachments to people back there, to places. She particularly wanted to go back to this little island in the Bay of Santiago where she had spent her summers, and they had been such magical summers for her, and she wanted to go back there and sort of reconnect. And so she did go back, and she went back without any, as I say, any sort of political agenda at all. She just wanted to go back and reconnect with her homeland, and it was a very emotional experience for her. She did find people that remembered her and her family from years ago. She had emotional connection with them. And she came back from that trip, interestingly enough, without any bitterness towards those Cubans who had stayed behind, those Cubans who had sided with Fidel Castro, who supported the revolution. She felt that that if she had been in their situation, she'd probably feel the same way. She didn't think that she had. She said she told me she had no desire to go back and reclaim anything that had been taken away from her or her family. She just felt a kind of an empathy with the Cubans that she met. And boy, I wish that attitude were more prevailing, because that would really augur well for reconciliation. The Cuban family at large is deeply divided, and the scars of that division, you know, are still felt. And it would be wonderful if there were more Cubans and Cuban Americans who could sort of come back together the way Amalia did with her Cuban friends and relatives.
Yeah. You know, the Bacardis had once cheered Fidel Castro from their hometown. And then it wasn't long before their business was seized and most of the family left. And it leaves me thinking, you know, what if? I'm sure that question occurred to you as well. How do you sort that out?
That what-if question is really important, because we sort of assume that everything was predestined to work out the way it did in Cuba, that Cuba was, you know, going through such a period of injustice that it would take this deep revolution to sort of set it on a different path. And one of the things that I learned is how many different alternative paths could have been taken. And you sort of do have to wonder, what if, you know, some of those other things had happened? What if the Bacardis, what if Fidel had embraced the support of people like the Bacardis and those allies of theirs in the business class and the bourgeoisie, as it's called, and really worked for a revolution that was more of a third way, you know, that was deep and profound and sweeping and introduced all kinds of social and economic reforms, but didn't go all the way to sort of result in the expulsion of 10% of the population. You know, how, you know, could Cuba have turned into a Sweden, you know, a kind of a social welfare state, a very advanced social welfare state? We don't know. The other what-if question, and I think this is probably the more discouraging one, is the truth is that the Bacardis were sort of the exception rather than the rule in Cuba. There were way too many wealthy families who were, in fact, allied with the dictator Batista. So the second what-if question is what if there had been more families like the Bacardis? Might that have made a difference? Might that have meant that Cuba would have turned out differently? These are all sort of academic. They're questions. They're interesting to explore in the context of a literary narrative. They don't really mean too much in the larger scheme of things, because we have what we have.
Yeah, yeah. Well, how are the Bacardis seen today in Cuba?
It depends on where you go, Celeste. The Bacardis, once they came into exile, having been the financiers of Fidel Castro's revolution, having been the strong force behind Cuba's struggle for independence in the 19th century, its struggle against dictators in the 20th century like Gerardo Machado and Batista, you know, the Bacardis went into exile with this whole tradition of political activism. And in exile, they turned that activism against Fidel Castro, and they became the leading financiers and supporters of the anti-Castro opposition in South Florida. And for that, they are seen by the Cuban government and by many people in Havana who are allied with the Cuban government as being sort of the arch enemies of the Cuban Revolution. Ricardo Alarcón, who was Fidel Castro's number sort of one assistant, his chief aide, at least for U.S. relations, told me that the Bacardis were the cornerstone of the counter-revolution. So from that point of view, they are seen with great scorn and contempt. But if you go to the other end of the island, if you go to Santiago, the second largest city in Cuba at the far eastern end of the island, where the Bacardis came from, they are still viewed with great affection there. There is still a Bacardi museum in Santiago. It was founded by Emilio Bacardi, the first Bacardi born in Cuba and a real patriot. He was the first mayor of Santiago. When he was mayor of Santiago, he accomplished a lot of things for the city. And as employers, the Bacardis were very warmly regarded. They were by far, of course, the biggest employer in Santiago. And many people in Santiago remember when Bacardi was the big employer in town. And so it's really different between Havana and Santiago. In Santiago, you find people on the street happy to talk about how affectionately they regarded the Bacardis.
Mm. This is truly an epic story. It's a wonderful story, the story of this family. Emilio Bacardi, what a fascinating man. A businessman, revolutionary, a writer, a diarist, a politician. What do you find
He's a real Renaissance man.
Yeah, what do you find most fascinating about him?
One of the things that I find fascinating about him is he was the founder of something called the Victor Hugo Freethinker Group in Santiago, and Victor Hugo was a kind of a 19th century libertarian, if you will, who sort of challenged the power of the state, challenged the power of the church, and really believed in free thinking. And Cuba in the 19th century was actually a pretty conservative society, where the crown, the Spanish crown, was dominant, and the church was dominant. And Emilio Bacardi, even though he was at the head of this wealthy business family, went out on a limb and was very outspoken and radical in a lot of his ideas. You know, he challenged the church. He was a bitter enemy of the church. He questioned the divinity of Jesus. He sent his daughters off to yoga school in California. He and his wife turned his own house in Santiago into kind of a yoga meditation center. This is around the turn of the century. So, you know, all of those things just don't jive with our sort of stereotypes of Cuban businessmen at that time. He was also, as you say, he was a literary figure in addition to being a businessman and a revolutionary, and he was a very prickly personality. He took offense very easily. This is often the case with people who have, of course, strong self-image and are very self-confident. He did not like people questioning his motives or his actions. And the opening lines of his last will and testament, Celeste, are ones that I wish I would dare put in my will. He says, the first line, he says, it's directed against his children. He says, all the evil things said against me are the lies of miserable and wretched men.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Journalist Tom Gelton is our guest this afternoon. His latest book is Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba, the biography of a cause. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. We also have a toll-free number, 800-222-9455. Well, let's back up a little bit now and talk about Emilio's father, and he had been born in Spain.
Right.
What led him to Cuba, and how did he decide to make rum?
Well, he was a Catalan from the Catalonia region of northeast Spain, and the Spain in the early part of the 19th century was going through a lot of economic difficulty. The Catalans were very energetic. They were kind of the merchant class in Spain, and many Catalans during that period went off to the New World in search of fortune and a better life. There was a whole colony of Catalans in Santiago. Facundo's father was an illiterate bricklayer, very poor, and his older brothers headed off to Santiago before him, and then as soon as Facundo was able to join them at about the age of 15, he went off. They all went into the grocery business, which was the shopkeeping business, which was what Catalans traditionally did in Cuba in those years. But Facundo was different from all of his brothers and from other Catalan merchants in that he really aspired to find his fortune. And he, after experimenting with different things, he decided that he could find his fortune making rum in Cuba. And it was actually a very smart move because even though Cuba was the largest sugar producer in the world at that time, there was no rum made in Cuba to speak of. But the rum came from the Caribbean islands. And one of the methods for making rum is to use fermented molasses. And molasses in the middle of the 19th century was fetching such a low price in the international market that many sugar planters just dumped it in the river or fed it to their hogs. And Facundo Bacardi sensed that this was a perfect opportunity to sort of build a rum industry on the basis of this raw material of molasses that's in such cheap and bountiful supply. And what he basically did, Celeste, that really explains his success, is that he pioneered a new type of rum. He recognized that as long as rum was a very rough drink, dark and strong tasting, it would have a limited market. But if someone could come up with a new style of rum that was light, easy to drink, that mixed well with other beverages, fruit juices and sodas and so forth, you'd be able to really expand the market of people who would drink rum. And he devoted several years to finding new filtration techniques, new aging techniques, experimented with different types of yeast, and eventually came up with this, with what we now know of as Bacardi rum, you know, a white, clear rum. There was no white, clear rum before Bacardi rum came along in the middle of the 19th century. And this vastly expanded the rum market. Women began drinking rum who had not been drinking it before, and it made possible the so-called age of cocktails in the early years of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. The daiquiri, the Cuba Libre, the mojito, all of these drinks were made possible because of the introduction of this new style light rum. And it really put Cuba on the map as far as rum was concerned, and it hadn't been there before.
Yeah. Now, was the Castro government able to maintain the distilling operations and the breweries, and have they been able to continue to make these drinks at such a high quality?
There's some dispute about that, but in general, I'd say the answer is yes. As I said at the beginning, the rum industry mm-hmm. in Cuba is actually in good shape today. It's one of the few businesses in Cuba that is actually probably worth saving and that has a promising future, no matter who's in charge there. And the reason for that is that rum making is a kind of a craft. And even when the Bacardis left Cuba, the workers that they left behind were craftsmen, and they knew how to make rum. And rum making by then was deeply part of the Cuban heritage. And so the fact that the owners of the factory, the Bacardi rum factory, left didn't mean that the rum making business was lost. Eventually the Castro government couldn't call it Bacardi rum anymore because the Bacardis had the rights to the brand. And the Bacardis will tell you that they took their secret formula with them, but I think that's a bit of a marketing overstatement. I think there was enough known about how to make rum on the part of the people that stayed behind that they were able to do it. And probably the most important part of the story is that the Bacardis left hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of barrels of aging rum, and that provided the stock to continue making rum for about 10 years, and it gave the Cubans a sort of a chance to sort of reorganize the rum industry in that period and continue it on their own. So there were a lot of problems in the rum industry in Cuba after the Bacardis left, but the industry survived and flourished, and rum made in Cuba today is a very popular product. You can't buy it in the United States because of the trade embargo, but you can buy it everywhere else around the world.
Yeah. One of the other products that comes to mind immediately when one thinks of Cuba is tobacco and the cigar.
Yeah.
Is there a parallel story there?
There is a parallel story in some respects. The tobacco industry, like the rum industry in Cuba, is a bright spot. It's going to flourish. It's doing very well now, and it will do very well in the future, regardless of whether you have a socialist government in Cuba or a capitalist government, whether you have a dictatorship or democracy. The rum industry and the tobacco industry is going to be very good. One difference is that the tobacco industry tended to be much more decentralized. I mean, it was really a lot of, tobacco mm-hmm. farmers, individual tobacco farmers, and they were allowed to continue operations in Cuba even under the Castro regime. So some of them have actually survived. There wasn't a single big family associated with Cuban tobacco the way there was with Cuban rum and the Bacardis. So there are some similarities and some differences.
Mm. Well, now let's go back in time to 1868. In Cuba, where when a war for independence began. Now, Emilio's father was a Spaniard.
Right.
Emilio and his brothers were Cubans.
Right.
Soon, Dad would find himself in trouble with the colonial authorities. What had led Emilio and his brothers to feel so strongly about Cuba, and how and why did his father begin to come around?
Well, Emilio and his brothers, of course, were all born in Cuba, and they came of age at just this time when the idea of a Cuban nationality was taking root. As you say, they considered themselves Cuban because they were born in Cuba, and the Cuban nationality, as it was emerging in those years, was seen conceptually as this sort of syncretism of European, African, and Native American elements that came together to produce this new thing called the Cuban race. And there was a flourishing of poetry, sort of celebrating the idea of Cuban and the idea of the Cuban nationality at that time. Everybody wanted to be a poet. And you had people like Jose Marti, who was writing about Cuba, and Cuba was struggling for its independence from Spain. All of these were the sort of the forces, the political and cultural forces that were swirling in Cuba in the middle of the 19th century as Emilio came of age. And he was a very smart young man. You know, part of the story, Celeste, is that because of a cholera epidemic in Santiago, Emilio's parents took him to live in Spain for a few years on his own with a family friend, and he was exposed as a result of his years in Spain to all these sort of liberal influences. And when he did come back from Spain, he was a very idealistic young man. He really believed that he was a fervent opponent of slavery, for example, even though his own family had been a slave-owning family. And he just came back. He was always a very literate guy. He read a lot from the time he was very young. His mother used to read to him in French. He obviously spoke Catalan. He spoke Spanish. He spoke French. And so he got swept up in this nationalist movement of those years. And his brother, his younger brother, Facundo Jr., sort of followed in his footsteps. And as far as his father was concerned, his father was always devoted above all things to his business. And because he was a native Spaniard, he felt more attachment to the old motherland than his children did. But he loved his kids and his sons. And when they got caught up in this movement and when he saw how cruelly the Spanish authorities were treating Cubans, he sort of gradually did come around and sympathize with them. He was always a little troubled by, you know, by their rabble rousing and their dabbling in revolutionary politics. But he supported them as a father, and he sympathized with their idealism. Mm.
I wonder what it was like to be around the dinner table in that family.
I don't think the family was all that unique in that regard.
Yeah.
I mentioned Jose Marti, for example, who's probably the best-known Cuban nationalist of all time. I mean, he's considered the apostle of Cuban independence. His father was actually a Spanish military officer in Cuba. So, you know, this idea of a kind of a split between one generation and the next was something that existed all over Cuba.
Yeah, but at the same time, and as you point out in the book, they're in favor of independence. On the other hand, they're also currying favor with the Spanish crown.
Yeah.
On behalf of their business.
Well, they're very clever. I mean, and this of course is something that's characterized business families, you know, around the world. I mean, they really did try to draw a line between their political activism and their commercial affairs, and they recognized how important the Spanish market was to the prospects of their rum business, and they recognized the value of putting on their label the awards that they had won in Spain. They were considered a purveyor to the Spanish crown, which is a very important honor. And so they did. They really did balance these two considerations pretty skillfully.
Yeah. That war that began in 1868 was a very long war, 10 years. And then following that war, there was another war known as the Little War.
Yeah.
And Emilio and many others found themselves at the end of the Little War under arrest, imprisoned in Spain. What happened to Emilio?
Well, many hundreds of Cuban patriots who got involved in this fight for independence during those years were executed. And I think Emilio was in sort of underground. He was a conspirator with the independence movement. He was channeling funds to the Cuban rebels up in the mountains to buy arms and ammunition. He was serving as a sort of a go-between between their supporters abroad and the fighters up in the mountains. I mean, he was pretty much the leader of the underground in Santiago. And he was, in fact, found out. He was arrested by Spanish authorities. And were it not for the fact that his father was a prominent Spaniard and the fact that he was head of the Bacardi Rum Company, which was already famous in those years, both in Cuba and in Spain, if it weren't for that, Emilio himself probably would have been executed, because people like him were executed all the time. As it was, he was taken off to Spain. He spent 3.5 years in prison in Spain at the end of that war, and then when fighting broke out again about 20 years later, he went back doing the same thing, and naturally suspicions fell on him, and he was arrested a second time. So he spent many years in prison in Spain as a result of his involvement in this revolutionary activity.
How did that affect him as a human being, as a man?
Well, I say in the book that imprisonment can sort of weaken a man, or it can strengthen a man. And I think Emilio is an example of those patriots over the years in different countries and different wars who have actually been strengthened by the experience of imprisonment. I mean, he came back. During his imprisonment, the fact that he was a wealthy businessman from Cuba meant nothing. He was thrown into prison along with illiterate Afro-Cubans who had been captured on the battlefield, and so it was sort of an equalizing experience. And I think one of the things that it did was it gave him a great sense of bond with sort of the common man, as it were. It made him more of a humanitarian. He also, his great leadership skills emerged during that period. And he learned patience, he learned forbearance, and those are all qualities that that became apparent in later years.
Mm-hmm. Into the 20th century now, how did Bacardi become Bacardi?
How did the Bacardi Rum Company become the Bacardi Rum? Yeah, well,
you know what I mean?
Yes, I do know what you mean, Celeste. And I think that, we get into these new generations. Emilio died in 1922. And the truth is that Emilio's great role in the history of this company is really more of a political role than it is a business role. I mean, his brother-in-law, when Don Facundo, the founder of the company, died in 1886, sort of the ownership of the company was then passed on to his children. He had three sons and a daughter. And his daughter, Amalia, married a French-Cuban by the name of Enrique Schweig, who was a brilliant businessman. And he is the one that really is responsible for developing the business outreach of Bacardi. And what he did in the early years of the 20th century was very important to the ultimate success of the company, and that's that he reached out internationally. He really developed the export market of Bacardi. Up until that time, Bacardi had been mostly a Cuban rum made and sold in Cuba. And Enrique Schweig, who was Amalia's husband, Emilio's brother-in-law, developed this whole export orientation. He took the product to international exhibitions all over the world, including in the United States. And then in the late 20s, he expanded production out of Cuba to Mexico. And then in the 1930s, he expanded production to Puerto Rico. So that eventually Bacardi, even though it was at its heart and soul a Cuban enterprise by a Cuban family, a Cuban company, it was really an international business. It was one of the first genuine multinational companies, and it was very unique in this regard. I mean, if you think about Scotch whiskey, for example, nobody ever thought of making Scotch outside of Scotland or cognac outside of France. But the Bacardis were the first to take what had been a national product, Cuban rum, and begin producing it in places all over the world. And that's what really ultimately made it such a huge success, such that Bacardi rum became the largest selling single spirits brand in the world.
Mm. Perhaps we should back up a little bit here and talk about that war that began in 1895. That was the Second War for Independence, because the U.S. was involved, the U.S. at war with Spain. How did that affect the Bacardis?
The Second War.
Yeah.
Well, Cuba by this time had been through about 50 years of struggle against Spanish rule. And as you say, there was first a 10-year war, then a little war, and then this other war. Basically, the Cuban economy was destroyed. The Cuban countryside had been ravaged. Plantations had been burned. So the whole Cuban economy was in just terrible, terrible shape. And the Bacardi Rum Company was on the verge of bankruptcy for decade after decade. I shouldn't even say verge of bankruptcy, because it actually was declared bankrupt on two or three occasions and sort of had to be reorganized. It was just barely keeping alive. And Emilio, the head of the company, was in prison. Many of the family members were in exile because it had become too dangerous in Santiago. It's remarkable that they were able to continue producing rum. It slowed down to a trickle for a while, but they actually stayed in operation throughout this war. And it was a tribute sort of to the deft political maneuvering. I mean, as we discussed before, Bacardi rum was popular with the Spanish. That perhaps saved it from the factory from being destroyed by Spanish forces. On the other hand, the rebels knew that, at least secretly, Emilio and his brothers were sympathizers to their cause, so the rebels spared it. So somehow, neither side went in and destroyed the Bacardi rum factory during those years of great fighting, and that's really what kept it alive.
Yeah. And then, thank goodness for U.S. Prohibition.
And then U.S. Prohibition is extremely important to the growth of the Bacardi rum industry, because Americans, after Prohibition, they of course couldn't drink freely in the United States, and Cuba is a very short distance away, a little steamship hop or an airplane trip, 1 hour, a couple of hours, and you're in Havana. And they went down there to drink, and what did they drink? They drank Bacardi rum. That's when Bacardi rum was really discovered by Americans, and this was the golden age of cocktails and nightclubs and gambling, and that's really when Bacardi sort of became, as I say, familiar to Americans. And what was interesting about this period, Celeste, is that sort of the politics, the political activism of the earlier struggles had sort of been gone by the wayside. Emilio Bacardi by this point is dead, and you sort of have lost some of the idealism and activism that had characterized Bacardi life in the earlier decades. But there was still this concept that Bacardi equaled Cuba. And it came out in a different way. It was manifested in a different way, in that Bacardi, when they were advertising their rum, they also advertised Cuba. There's a famous ad that I found in U.S. magazines from that period that said, and it was headlined, "Cuba is great. There is a reason Bacardi." So this was characteristic of Bacardi advertising in those years. It not only promoted Bacardi rum, it promoted Cuba as a kind of a destination, as a country. And another ad that ran in Cuban newspapers showed, for example, a young Cuban couple having a drink at a sidewalk cafe, and it's clear that this is in Paris because the Eiffel Tower is in the background, and the waiter is serving them a drink of Bacardi. And Cubans in those years thought all good things come from Paris. Like many people did. But the caption said, "Bacardi rum, it doesn't come from Paris, it goes to Paris." The idea that Bacardi is actually making Cuba famous around the world. And so there was this kind of promotional aspect, this kind of boosterism aspect to Bacardi advertising in those years. And, this went on for decades. Bacardi was the leading corporate patron of Cuban baseball. When Cuban baseball games were first broadcast on television, Bacardi was the sponsor. It was the leading corporate patron of art and music. The Cubans in those years listened to their music on the radio every night. And who was the sponsor of those programs? It was Bacardi. They had a program on every night at 10 o'clock called Fiesta con Bacardi, Party with Bacardi. And so Bacardi became associated, sort of with all things Cuban, not just the politics, but baseball and music and dance and everything.
All the good stuff. Tom Gelton is our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. His latest book, Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba, The Biography of a Cause. We have a listener waiting to talk with us on line one in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
An entertaining program. You've referred to the Bacardis as being Spanish several times. And I think they might take exception to that. They were Catalans. And they would have considered themselves as coming from Catalonia.
Yeah, I think
Mr. Johnton corrected me on that.
Yes, I had a friend, 50 years or so ago, traveling in Spain, and at one point he was in Catalonia, and he happened to visit a pet shop. And there was a parrot. He was admiring the parrot. He asked the shop owner, does he speak? And he said, yes. And then he said, what language? And he drew himself up, and he said rather some distaste, Catalan, of course. I think that explains something.
It does. And Celeste, you asked me before, why did Facundo sympathize with the patriotism, the Cuban nationalism of his sons? And, you know, part of that is the Catalans had always felt a little bit alienated from Madrid. So I think that there was something in Don Facundo's Catalan heritage that made him it easier for him to sympathize with this kind of anti-Spanish activism of his children. But in a sense, there was no such thing as Spain. I mean, Spain was a bunch of different regions. There was the Castilian region of Spain. There was the Galicia, and there was Catalonia. So, I mean, Spain has always been kind of an amalgam of different regions, nationalities, languages, and Madrid was in the, the Castilian part of Spain. And when we say Spanish, what we really mean is Castilian. But that's maybe not a distinction that I clarified enough in our conversation. But the caller is absolutely right. Yeah. The Bacardis were from Catalonia.
Yeah. Before we go much further, we should talk about Fidel Castro here. One of the interesting things I think about reading about Castro in your book, Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba, was that even though the rebels were ill-equipped and disorganized, Castro had the advantage of imagination. How was he able to pull it off? Imagination.
That's true. Fidel Castro is brilliant, a brilliant, brilliant man, brilliant politically. I talk about, one little moment in my book that in hindsight was masterful, and that's when the Cuban Revolution triumphed. Fidel found himself in Santiago at the eastern end of the island as opposed to being in Havana, the capital, where the population was and where Batista had been. And sort of a normal revolutionary leader at that moment coming down out of the mountains, arriving in Santiago, would have immediately flown to Havana. I mean, the people were out in the streets celebrating the triumph of the revolution. But Fidel didn't do that. Instead, he took this very slow overland trip in a jeep, starting out in Santiago. It actually took him 6 days to get to Havana. And that, as I say, few people would have thought of doing that in that moment. And, lesser politicians would have rushed to the adulation of the crowds in Havana. But he took this slow overland trip. And what he did by that was to introduce himself to the entire Cuban population so that by the time he ultimately reached Havana, he was seen in nearly divine proportions. I mean, there was a magazine that actually showed a picture of Fidel with a halo above his head, if you could imagine that. I mean, by taking his time to get to Havana, he so glorified his own position. And over the years, Fidel has been brilliant about this, about sort of sensing what he can do politically to improve, to sort of strengthen himself. And people often ask me, what is the greatest achievement of the Cuban Revolution? And I think they're assuming I'm going to talk about health or education or something like that. But the greatest achievement of the Cuban Revolution is simply a political achievement, and that's that Fidel Castro put together a regime that was able to stay in power for 50 years despite the hostility of its neighbor to the north, the United States, the most powerful country in the world. That is a stunning political achievement. I mean, it took a repressive apparatus. It took a totalitarian approach. But I think the political achievement cannot be understated.
Mm. Let's take another call, a listener in Champaign on line one.
Yeah, I have two quick questions.
Okay.
What yoga school, you mentioned daughters were sent to yoga school in California around the turn of the 20th century. I'd be curious what wasn't aware that there was anything out there in California at that time. Just curious. And two, did this family get involved in any of the complex or in any way, shape, or form complicated set of CIA mafia plots that were attempting to overthrow Castro after the revolution? And I'll hang up and listen on the...
Okay.
On the
Well, you should really read my book because I have a whole chapter devoted to that that period. It's called Counter-Revolution. And the short answer is yes. Pepin Bosch, who was the chairman of the board of Bacardi during the time when Fidel Castro came to power, he was actually Fidel Castro's sort of best ally among Cuban businessmen, and then he became his worst enemy. And he went from having supported Fidel financially to supporting efforts to overthrow Fidel. He actually, at one point, even went so far as to purchase an airplane. He tried to find some volunteer pilot to fly this B-26 bomber back to Cuba and bomb the oil refineries. So Pepin Bosch was very much an activist in the anti-Castro movement, and that, of course, did bring him into contact with the CIA. He founded an organization of Cuban exiles that had CIA support. Ultimately, I think he was a little bit too much of a maverick to continue just as a lackey of the CIA, and so a lot of the times he sort of went off on his own. But he did have a lot of connections with the CIA during that kind of revolutionary period. As far as the yoga school, this was in San Diego. I'm trying to remember. I think it was called the Raja. If you give me a few minutes, I'll look through this. I think it was the Raja Yoga School in San Diego.
Okay. And if I'm not mistaken, Pepin Bosch, he married into the Bacardi family. And also, when he was a supporter of Castro, didn't he arrange some meeting to try and allay the fears of the U.S. government and the CIA?
That's right. See, Pepin Bosch was, in those years, right before Fidel came to power and even after Fidel came to power, the first year or so, as I said, Pepin Bosch and other Bacardis were real strong supporters of Fidel. And this was a period of time when there were a lot of uncertainties about where Fidel Castro was going to take Cuba, about whether he was somebody who could be trusted. The CIA was very nervous about him. The whole U.S. government was very nervous about him. And Pepin Bosch in Santiago, as the head of the Bacardi Rum Company, became friends with a CIA operative in Santiago who was sent to Santiago with the mission of sort of reporting on this underground guerrilla movement. And Pepin Bosch was friends with the CIA agent. He was also friends with the Castro's guerrillas, and he, in fact, did arrange a meeting between Fidel's people and the CIA agent and others who came to town with the intent of sort of trying to reassure the United States that this was actually a movement that could be, you know, that was nothing to be afraid of.
Hmm. I have a last question here, and we'll have to wrap it up pretty quickly. I'm sorry I can't give you too much time. At the near the close of your book, you say part of the Cuban question now is whether and how its past and future can be reconnected. And you say at the end, at the very close, a transition to a new chapter of Cuban history is unlikely to be easy. From your perspective, after spending all this time, what are your thoughts about this big question?
About the future of
Cuba? Yeah.
Well, I think that Fidel Castro has not done any favors for the Cuban people by the way that he has run Cuba. And I'm not just saying that, you know, I'm not just saying that he's been a dictator, et cetera. I think that, in a sense, his greatest failing has been that he has not really supported the development of institutions, political institutions in Cuba that have authority and power separate from the personality of Fidel Castro or even the personality of Raul Castro. The one thing that you need to do if you want your revolution or your movement to outlive you, you need to encourage the development of institutions that can sort of carry on that tradition. And the Cuban Revolution for so long has been so personified in the person of Fidel Castro that it's really hard to find any institutions
that can carry it on independently of who is at the top. I think that is the greatest failing of the Castro brothers. Now, it's possible Raul is a little bit less sort of megalomaniac than Fidel, so maybe in these years when Raul is in charge, he can do that. I think he has in some ways empowered the Cuban Communist Party in ways that it was not empowered under Fidel. But I think that is the challenge, because if Fidel and Raul both disappear from the scene anytime in the short run, I think it's likely that there will be a very bitter succession struggle. There will be chaos. There's likely to be a major vacuum of authority. And that is not going to be a situation that is conducive, you know, to sort of further progress in Cuba in the short run.
Mm. What a story. Tom Jelton, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
It's my pleasure, Celeste. Thank you.
Tom Jelton is the author most recently of Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba, the biography of a cause. The publisher is Viking. And that interview was conducted on February 20th of this year. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. It's 4 minutes before 2 o'clock. No markets today because of the observance of Good Friday. Camilo José Vergara has seen the face of God. He has seen it all over America, on streets and murals, on storefront porches. He's a photographer, and his series on the Passion of Christ is part of an upcoming exhibit at the National Building Museum. Claire O'Neill introduces us to the artist and his work.
Imagine this. You're in a small one-bedroom apartment in New York City, and all of your storage is occupied by boxes and boxes of photographs.
Many hundreds of thousands.
That's Camilo José Vergara, and that's how many photos he's taken. Many hundreds of thousands, which is easy to do if you have a digital camera, but he's using film. His photos show how neighborhoods change, how storefronts become churches, and how depictions of Jesus really vary from place to place. He recalls what it was about these images that initially caught his eye.
It was Christ that were white and blue-eyed, and Christ that were Africans, and Christ that were clearly Latino, and they all came together and sort of acted the part in different places. Some of them were really very accomplished pieces of work, and some of them were very rough, and, you know, I liked them both.
One photo shows a giant Jesus airbrushed on a wall carrying a cross. In the foreground, a homeless man hunches over a shopping cart, pushing with determination. In another photo, Jesus looks more like a beefed-up football player ready to break the cross in half. And in another, he's being flayed, but he's also advertising on a billboard for Mama's Chicken and Ice Cream. What's most interesting is where Vergara finds these images of Christ. From Skid Row in L.A. to Detroit to Camden, New Jersey, he's drawn to tough urban areas. That's where he keeps finding God.
I found that many of those images had been placed in some of the most dangerous places in America by ministers or priests that thought that putting the image of Christ there was a deterrent that was going to stop people from committing crimes in that alley. You don't mess around with Christ too much. You know, Christ still has power. That's what I realized. And then as I was putting it together, you know, I realized that Christ still has power in my life.
He says he's not a religious person, and yet religious themes keep showing up in his work. He's best known for his book called How the Other Half Worships. It's a visual study of what religious America looks like, from churchgoers to their places of worship.
I once went to a service where there was a minister, a woman, and her two kids were there. And that was the entire extent of the service. And it was in a basement, and she had borrowed the basement. Sometimes people put up a cross in the middle of an empty lot in a place like Detroit, and then they put chairs around it, and that's the place where they worship. So the idea that you hear often repeated is that the church doesn't matter. What matters is that the people come together and pray to God as a community, as a group of people.
This Easter weekend, Vergara will be back in Detroit. He'll be visiting a nephew and, in his words, most likely photographing. His exhibit, Storefront Churches, comes to D.C.'s National Building Museum in June. Claire O'Neill, NPR News.
It's 2 o'clock Central Time. This is WILL.